Just give a very brief introduction and then go on to talk about these parks multi-beam surveys that have been happening in the last few years. Then a rather brief discussion of other recent surveys. And finally, I'll just say a few words about globular cluster surveys, although they're not strictly young neutron stars, I guess. But this workshop does seem to have spilled over into sort of pulsars in general. So this is the galactic distribution of pulsars as of 1997. These are radio pulsars or active pulsars that we can see in George's terminology. So they're beamed at us. There's 701 dots on that plot, and most of you have probably seen it before, or something similar. So I'm preaching to the converted here, I guess, but just briefly, why do we need to find more pulsars? It's a bit floaty. Well, there are quite a few reasons, which I won't elaborate on. They are very good clocks, and we all know there's all sorts of interesting things you can do with good clocks, especially in binary systems. They're excellent probes of the interstellar medium. If you do a big survey, there's two reasons why you do it, really. One is that you want to improve the statistics on population studies, birth rates, distributions, so on. But the other reason is that you're very likely to find some unique or almost unique object which is especially interesting. And that's sort of half the motivation for doing these big surveys. And so I've just elaborated on that down there. Okay, well, going straight on then to the multi-beam surveys at parks. There has actually been one or two other multi-beam surveys at parks which I haven't listed here. These are the ones which relate to the disk population of pulsars. And there are two main surveys that have been going on. One which we call the Parkes Multi-Beam Survey, we sort of appropriated that name, is a collaboration, a fairly large group, including Andrew Lyon and Vicky Caspi on the TV over there, and other people. We started it in mid-1997, and it uses the multi-beam receiver on the Parkes telescope. Most of you have probably seen pictures of the Parkes telescope, or you will when you get to see the movie, The Dish, which is about to be released. I understand it's a good movie, you should go and see it. Sorry? I didn't hear that crack, but it's about Apollo 11. This is the multi-beam receiver. We don't actually observe with it like this. This is as it's being hoisted up into the receiver cabin. And you can see it has 13 feeds. These are the ends of the feeds. The feeds are in here. The center beam, two hexagonal rings around that. So effectively we can survey the sky 13 times as fast as you can with just a single normal system. So that makes a huge difference to the effectiveness of these surveys. So the multi-beam, or our multi-beam survey, is covering the galactic plane, a 10 degree wide strip from 260 through the galactic center through to 50 degrees. Sampling interval is a quarter of a millisecond, and we spend 35 minutes on each point. That's quite a long time, and so that gives us a very high sensitivity of about 0.15 millijanskis, and that's about 7 times better than any previous survey of this type. So we do expect to find lots of pulsars, and in fact we do. The other survey that has been done by Russell Edwards and Matthew Bales, and who are both here, and their colleagues from Swinburne, is complementary to our survey. It covers the same longitude range and an extra 10 degrees on either side of our strip. They used a somewhat shorter sampling interval, half in fact, and a shorter time per pointing, and so their limiting sensitivity is not as high, but there are some advantages in doing it that way. I'll get it finished quickly. There's one. So where are we at with these surveys? Well, the multi-beam survey, we've done about 80% of the pointings so far. There's 2,600 odd pointings to complete the survey. We've processed most of these through to checking candidates on the telescope, and so far we've confirmed 583 previously unknown pulsars. So if you remember, we started off before the survey with about 700. This is a big number. In that 583, there's just two MSPs, and there are eight in binary systems. The Swinburne survey is complete. Found 58 pulsars and a much higher proportion of MSPs. Seven MSPs plus another one, which is probably of the sort of low magnetic field class, and six of these are binary. Have you got a poster or something, Russell? Where is he? Didn't bring one, no. Anyway, that's Russell. So if you want to find out more about the Swinburne survey, you can talk to him. This is the galactic distribution now with the new ones on it. The yellow crosses are a bit hard to see. They're the Swinburne survey. The red stars, asterisks, are too many of them. They're all on top of one another. Basically, it just shows you the regions of the plane which have been surveyed. If we plot the distribution of dispersion measure for the previously known disk pulsars, in fact, this is all known disk pulsars, I think, the Swinburne survey and the multi-beam survey, you can see all three distributions are different. The Swinburne one concentrates at lower dispersion measures, which is not surprising since they're only searching off the plane. The multi-beam survey, the median DM is up here at a few hundred. And again, that's not surprising in the sense that we're looking right in the plane with very high sensitivity, so we're finding distant pulsars. If you use the famous Taylor and Cordes model for the electron density in the galaxy to convert those dispersion measures to distances, you end up with a plot that looks like that. I guess the points to remark on here are that the multi-beam pulsars tend to be much more distant than previously known ones, especially, and more distant even than the Swinburne ones. There seems to be a clustering of pulsars along spiral arms here, which looks very significant. It's not clear yet whether or not that is in fact significant, because the distance model itself will cluster things along the arms. As you integrate up the dispersion measure, pulsar sort of whips across these interarm regions and then sits around in the arm for quite a while as you accumulate dispersion. So it may be that there is a significant concentration in the arms, but that diagram by itself doesn't prove that. We look at the period distribution. Nothing too surprising here. The Swinburne survey, as I remarked, has a much higher proportion of millisecond pulsars than the multi-beam survey. We are hoping to find more MSPs with the multi-beam survey. We're about to embark on an acceleration analysis of the data, reprocess all the data. So that hopefully will increase this red area over here. There are a couple of things that are worth noting about this. The Parkes multi-beam has found a large number of pulsars in this region, quite interesting, several of them in binary systems. So there are periods about a tenth of a second. It's also found several pulsars in this region. In fact, just in the last week, we've realized that two of the pulsars that we discovered have 6 second periods. Now, I was specifically asked to address the issue of sensitivity of these surveys. This is a plot done by Froney Crawford, a student of Vicky's, who was a collaborator on this survey, of the sensitivity of the Parkes multi-beam survey. It's a fairly complicated variation as a function of period, and these different lines here are for different dispersion measures, zero dispersion measure and up to 1,000. For millisecond pulsars, you can see as you have a very hard job detecting distant millisecond pulsars just because of the dispersion smearing, and the scattering I don't think is taken into account in these calculations, so that makes it even worse. But even for a zero dm pulsar, you have a degradation in sensitivity when you get down toward a millisecond. These steps result from the different number of harmonics that you're able to see dropping off as you go to higher frequencies. No, this is theory. But a fairly complete theory. He modelled the entire system right through, including all the filtering and so on that takes place in both hardware and software. At the other end, we have a software cutoff at 5 seconds, but we can still detect longer period pulsars because we detect them in their second or third harmonic, and so we still have sensitivity out here, but it too drops off as you go to a longer period. For about 200 or nearly 300 of the multi-beam pulsars, we have period derivatives now. Russell also has measured period derivatives for most of his objects, and this is a rather complicated diagram, standard PP dot diagram, showing virtually all the known radio pulsars, all the disc ones, oh no, all of them in fact, on this diagram. Most of you have seen these diagrams before, so I'll just comment on a few things. There are these binary systems in here. The ring around the symbol means it's a binary pulsar. So there's this bunch here, which are quite interesting, with periods of a bit less than a tenth of a second. The multi-beam survey has found a disproportionate number of young, high-field radio pulsars. If you take medians of the multi-beam survey and other known pulsars, these are a much younger group, which immediately shows you that there's a correlation between luminosity and age or magnetic field. And in particular, the three highest magnetic field radio pulsars have been found in this survey. They all have fields of a few by 10 to the 13 Gauss, that's dipole fields. And they're up close to some of these objects, which are the X-ray pulsars. So there's a question as to why this pulsar, for example, is a radio pulsar, whereas this one is an AXP. They're very close on this diagram. Similar questions you can ask about these two here. This is the KISS, the 700-year-old pulsar, which was just announced recently. And this is one of our radio pulsars, which is very close on this diagram, but they have very different properties. This one over here is a mistake. That's one that is thought to be in orbit around a BE star, and the derivative is due to the orbital motion, most probably, and not the not a true spin down, but unfortunately in the catalogue it didn't get I just put the P dot in at face value without realising it would show up way up there. So that's probably all we need to say about that. Where am I going? Quarter of an hour. The binary pulsars that have been discovered in this survey fall into a couple of groups, or maybe three groups. These are basically circular orbit systems with rather light, well, not so light companions, in fact. They include several of these pulsars with periods up just below a tenth of a second, and they have these quite heavy companions. So they form an interesting group, rather different to most of the so-called recycled systems. Then we have these eccentric systems down here, which also are all quite interesting. This one is most probably a double neutron star system. The pulsar is very old, rather weak magnetic field, so it naturally seems to be of the double neutron star class. But this one is different. It has a very short orbital period, only a few hours, and the pulsar is very young, about a million years old. So it seems to be in the same group as, was it 23 something or other, where the neutron star is probably the second born compact star in the system. And then finally, we have this one down here, 1740, which is a very interesting source. It has a highly eccentric orbit, which I'll show you in a moment, I think, in a 231-day period. But the thing that makes this particularly interesting is that the minimum mass is 11 solar masses. So I'll just say a few more. Oh, I've got one more picture before I get onto that. Russell Edwards produced this diagram, which shows the distribution of companion masses. I haven't quite fit it all on. For the circular orbit disk pulsars. So I think there's a couple of things worth remarking on here. There's a distinction between this higher mass group and these ones. There's the fact that this distribution here doesn't seem to have too many systematics about it. There's proposed to be a relationship between orbital period and companion mass, which perhaps you can see in this part of the diagram, but certainly it doesn't seem to work for these. It should go on up here. The other thing that's been talked about in the past is this so-called gap in this region, which Russell has neatly filled in there with this object. So these gaps in this distribution are of little or no statistical significance. It may still be that these really are a different population to these, but it doesn't seem possible to rely on the fact that there's a large gap here to support that. As Russell points out, this gap here, if you don't count these higher mass systems, is of the same significance as these gaps here now. So this high mass object then, 1740, it's very interesting. This is the velocity curve for it. You can see it's quite eccentric. And one of the interesting things about it is that at periastron, we can still see the pulsar. Now, of course, with an 11 solar mass companion, you wonder what the companion is. There's really only two possibilities. One is that it has to be a rather massive, sort of more or less ordinary star, or it has to be a black hole. Now, of course, we would like it to be a black hole because it would be the first neutron star black hole system known. But the evidence mostly seems to point in the other direction. This object is very close to the galactic center, both in its coordinates and in its distance, most probably. It has quite a high dispersion measure, and its computed distance is comparable to that of the galactic center. So there's a huge amount of obscuration, so you can't do ordinary optical measurements, but you can do infrared measurements. And this is an infrared image taken at Siding Spring of the region, and there is this star which is very close to the position of the radio pulsar. We did two things. We used the compact array of the Australia telescope, that's a 6 kilometre array, to measure a very accurate position for the radio pulsar to uncertainty of about 0.3 of an arc second. And we did very careful astrometry with the help of some of our optical colleagues of the optical position of this star, or the infrared position of it. And these two positions agree to better than 0.3 of an arc second. So that certainly suggests that star is in fact the companion. There's supporting evidence from the spectrum of the star. It has this emission at bracket gamma, which is normally associated with the presence of a compact object. And it suggests that this star does in fact have a compact companion. However, the puzzles are that we don't see eclipses, at least at around a gigahertz. We can see the pulsar right through periastron, and we've observed a couple of periastrons, or one and a half, since that first one. The pulsar comes within a quarter of a stellar radius of the star at periastron. So it's 1.25 stellar radii away from the center of the star. And so one would expect some effects to be evident from that. If not eclipses, then tidal effects or precessional effects on the longitude of periastron, and no such effects are seen. We do have a measurement of omega dot, the longitude of periastron, but it's very, very small, about two orders of magnitude less than the predicted tidal effect. We do have some evidence for dispersion measure changes as the pulsar goes through periastron, but these are probably right, but may not be. So there's still a question mark about the nature of the companion of this object. It's improbable, but not impossible, that in fact all the evidence, such as the positional coincidence and so on, are in fact misleading us, and that the companion really is a black hole. Okay, so 5 minutes? Right. Well, other surveys, I can cover that in a couple of minutes. I can't resist putting up this diagram, which is the pulsars discovered since 1997. The red is the Parkes Molly Beam Survey, the yellow is the Swinburne Survey, and the blue is the rest of the world. In fact, even a few Parkes ones in that. I have to admit that telescopes falling down or being repaired or being upgraded is a large part of the reason for this great discrepancy, but there's no doubt Parkes has done pretty well in the last few years. So the surveys that have gone on, there have been a series of drift scan surveys done at Arecibo as the telescope was being upgraded. Bond did a sort of little, what they called a pilot study of a deep search at 1400 megahertz. And there's a Parkes survey, which also used a multi-beam survey of the Magellanic Cloud region, which found a few pulsars. I've only listed here the surveys that found more than one pulsar. There's been a few that found one. In any case, the total in all is 27, according to my counting. And I should thank David Nice and Duncan Lorimer for helping me bring our pulsar catalogue up to date. Paolo Ferreira is here, just arrived, and he, I think, is going to talk on Friday about 47 Tuck. But I'll just say a brief introduction to that. The centre beam of the multi-beam survey, multi-beam instrument, has been used to look at 47 Tuck. 47 Tuck is in the other part of the sky from the galaxy, and so every day when we're doing the multi-beam survey, we wonder what to do in the anti-centre time, and we look at 47 Tuck. And that has actually turned out to be extraordinarily productive. There have been 9 new pulsars discovered in 47 Tuck. These are the 11 previously known. These are 9 new ones. All of these are binary. They were discovered in using acceleration code, so it clearly indicates that the intrinsic population has a large proportion of binaries, probably more binary than single. I might leave the rest of this talk to Paolo, I think. I'll just show one of these pictures that I brought along, which I think is pretty interesting. We've managed to get accurate timing on 15 of these pulsars now, and for 4 of those we have proper motions by comparing the observations that were made 10 years ago with the recent observations and looking at the difference in the positions derived from the timing of these pulsars. We've been able to measure the proper motion of 4 of these pulsars. The proper motion is completely dominated by the motion of the cluster as a whole. The individual motion of the pulsars within the cluster is less than our uncertainty, or it should be, and almost certainly is. So what we're measuring here is the motion of the cluster, and these measurements are completely consistent with independent measurements based on Hipparchos data, and in fact have already surpassed these measurements in accuracy. You take the mean of them. So I'll leave the rest of that to Paolo. I'll just finish up by showing the results of a very recent set of observations or analysis anyway, again of globular clusters. This work's been led by Nicky D'Amico, one of our collaborators from Bologna, and he's been searching a variety of clusters, 4 pulsars, and we've now found pulsars in 4 clusters which had no previously known pulsars. That's important because that means that you have to search a wide range of dispersion measure. Finding pulsars in clusters with the previously known pulsar is a lot easier than finding them in these clusters that have no previously known pulsar, and especially when they have short orbital periods. So these are the 4. You can see the things. All of the pulsars have periods in the range of a few milliseconds. All are binary. And these are the so-called phase time diagrams, which I probably don't have to explain here. The binary motion is very clear and very beautiful, if you like this sort of thing. This particular one is eclipsed for 40% of its orbit. The others, there's no evidence yet of eclipses. And this, the other one I'll mention specifically, is this one in 6544. This is almost certainly the radio continuum source that was observed by Fruchter and Goss. The flux is the same within the uncertainty. But the most interesting thing about this one is a very short orbital period, 1.7 hours. It's the second shortest orbit for any radio pulsar. And the orbit is very small as well. And the companion mass that you derive is 10 Jupiter masses. So it's almost a planet system. If that's, of course, the minimum mass, if the system is face-on, then it could be larger. But this is an interesting group of objects which we will follow up on. So I'll stop there. Thank you. Well, the question was how many pulsars would you expect to find in 47 based on the stellar population? I'm not sure you can base the answer to that question on the stellar population. We just don't know enough about how these things are formed. But if you look at the radio pulsar population that we do know about now and make some extrapolations based on that, you're purely sensitivity limited. So if you have a higher sensitivity instrument, you'll find more pulsars, there's no doubt about that. How many you might end up finding, or how many so-called active pulsars are there in the cluster, it's a very uncertain number, but it's almost certainly many hundreds.
If I could follow on, your answer was kind of my point, that the stellar population is known well enough, you should be able to make a pretty good prediction about the number of events that led to neutron star formation. And so the ratio of pulsars that you see to neutron stars, you should be there because an interesting number for addressing them.
Well, if that's true, I'd like to know more about it. I thought there was still a fair amount of uncertainty both about the initial mass function and also about how these things are formed, you know, and these exchange interactions and, you know, blue stragglers and all the rest of it. I think you have a lot of scope for factors of 10 in there, but maybe I'm wrong. The question was, are there X-ray limits on the high magnetic field pulsars? There is on at least one of them, in fact two of them, I think. And these limits, the limit of current technology. So they're definitely less X-ray emission from 1119, the 1700-year-old one, than from an AXP, and I think the same is true for this 4-second one, which is very close to the AXP.
Does that include the luminosity correction, or is that significant given this component?
Yes, yeah. The question was, how do we detect the long period pulsars? No, the software prohibits us from detecting the fundamental of any pulsar with a period longer than 5 seconds. That's the reason for that limitation is mainly just the presence of interference and general sort of red noise in the spectrum. We just get heaps of garbage if we allow all that stuff through. But as long as these pulsars have a reasonably sharp pulse, which I guess not surprisingly the ones we've detected have, they do have quite strong harmonic emission. So we detect that, and then for a few months we usually think we've found a 3-second pulsar. But then eventually we do some checks and we realise that it's actually a 6-second pulsar. Yeah. It comes through looking like a shorter period pulsar with a period of a half or third of the true period. The question is, do we have problems detecting nulling pulsars? Yeah, if they happen to be in a null state when we're pointing in that direction, of course we don't detect them. So there's a fraction of the active pulsar population which we don't see, which we don't detect. Sometimes in our sort of slightly crazier moments we think about redoing some of these surveys to find these, but it's really not worth the effort because they're probably only 5% or at most 10%. Especially in this survey where scintillation is not really a problem. In some other surveys, one is seriously affected by scintillation, and that also reduces the proportion of the existing population that you see, but that's not true for this survey. So the incentive to go back and redo it all is very low. I thought you'd be pleased, Josh.
Now that you've got the VM, can you go back and look at some of the older data and dig deeper and look for others? The comparisons with 47 are really fascinating.
Yes, we can. In fact, for one of those clusters, the low DM one, which is not 6397, I don't think, we have in fact found three pulsars. Having determined the DM, we've gone back and dug deeper. 6397, we can do that, but we haven't yet. And they're going to be weak if they're there. But there could be some. But that's work in progress.
And how long for the timing solution to the one you've got? Because the companion mass looks very much like a helium white dwarf.
Yeah. I don't think there's any fundamental reason why we shouldn't get a timing solution within 12 months. On that one.
For the final pulsar with the 230-day period, I missed how do you infer the entire distance from 125? How certain is the number based on
infrared? The question was for the 11 solar mass system, how do we infer the distance of closest approach?
Yeah, 1.25.
Yeah. That's just based on the simple, orbital solution. And I think that's also includes a best estimate of the inclination angle given some of the modelling that you might do on this the spectrum and so on of this star. So it's not the 90 degree distance, but it's, I think it, from what I remember, it's 60 degrees or something has been assumed. But of course there is an uncertainty in that angle still.
There must be a very high probability that it would eclipse when, if it really does get within a quarter of the solar radius.
Yeah.
Were you observing at the time when it allegedly behind the...
Yes. Yes. Yeah. It's very strange. Well, they're of marginal significance. They're sort of like 4 sigma, I think. But it's a tricky business because you've got the orbital solution and the low frequency measurements are not usually done at exactly the same time as the high frequency measurements. And so there is scope for error, but But they do look believable, but the thing that really worries us is the omega dot. There's just, you know, no omega dot there, and there should be.
Did Vicky have a question?
She might have a comment and question as well.
I was just going to ask you to repeat the question.
Yeah, what was the question? I think the question from Matthew was how believable are the DM changes and so on. Is that right, Matthew? Something like that, anyway.
Well, my follow-up question is, at what frequency did we observe this system?
The follow-up question was, at what frequency did we observe this system? Just 50 centimetres, well, no, 50... 600 megahertz, 1.4 gigahertz, and 2.3 gigahertz. But there are a lot of problems with the 2.3 gigahertz data, and we in fact haven't used it. So the DM is just based on 600 and 1.4. Ben? Sorry? No, we haven't done that. The question was, have we looked at the radio continuum data close to periastron, or the position determination was done away from periastron. There's no evidence for any compact source, but you wouldn't really expect one. We haven't looked exactly at periastron.
I'd like to ask, when you say that you don't see an omega dot and it's two orders of magnitude below your expectation is based on static tide?
Yes, but we have also tried to understand what dynamic tides might do, and our understanding is not that complete, and I hope it might improve over the course of this meeting if I can talk to a few people. But Vicky's talked to you about it, I think.
Yeah.
So we have tried to consider the effect of dynamic tides, but at least to me it's not entirely clear what that is.
Okay, so we'll convene in half an hour. Got a lot of things.